If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Could you imagine yourself here in this situation? Cop, suspect, gun, taser, suspect subdued. In this case, in South Carolina, the suspect killed, shot in the back by an officer. The charge, murder. But you can hear the anxiety in the person making this video. Who am I? Am I in trouble here? Are they going to shoot me? Oh my goodness. Is this evidence of a crime? Am I supposed to be doing this? All of those reactions, his fear for himself, for the dying suspect, represent a major turning point in law enforcement in America. Faden Santana said he was walking home from his job when he switched on his phone cam. Years ago, in the famous Rodney King case, the video shooter had to go and find his camera in a box and record a scene that was happening outside his window. Cameras are everywhere today, on police in the form of body cams, in the hands of citizens in the form of cell phone videos and other even smaller recording devices. About a quarter of U.S. police departments are either using body cameras or are starting to implement them. How important is this moment? Joining us is Chuck Wexler, Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Chuck Wexler, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm just really puzzled by the manifestations here and all the implications of the cameras that are out there. And I'm wondering how you see this as either different or similar to the proliferation of cameras and microphones for all kinds of public people, politicians, celebrities, that sort of thing.
Well, when it comes to the police, cameras have really become very significant. And certainly in the incidents we've seen, you know, in the last week and even over the last few years, and people want accountability, and body cameras have become very significant. So there's really good reasons to have police have body cameras. There's a part of me, though, that also thinks that we really need to somehow preserve the relationship between citizens and police officers. It sort of goes back to Sir Robert Peel talking about the importance of working with the community. So every encounter can't be, excuse me, but you're being recorded. If that happens every time, we're going to lose something here.
Is it your belief, and is it the belief of officers, that every time they're being recorded by someone with a phone cam, that that's some kind of a confrontation?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, look, what the police do is very important, but it should be very public. There should not be anything about what the police do that anyone should have to question. So no, that makes everybody accountable. So no, that shouldn't be a problem. The police should never say to someone, you can't record this. I mean, if they're saying you can't record this, this is a problem with what they're doing.
And what about the arc, if we go from the Rodney King video to the video in South Carolina?
Right.
It seems to me, as a news reporter who covered all of these stories, that there's been a shift. I mean, I think the Rodney King tape was very difficult to watch. It was hard to understand what the cops were doing. Nevertheless, there was a sense that the presumption of innocence of the cops was kind of the social norm there, except for African Americans, of course, who had a very different view. And we discovered that in the Rodney King, subsequent verdicts, that sort of thing. It seems in South Carolina that the burden has completely shifted, that the assumption is almost that the police were doing something wrong, and had the camera not been there, they would have just gotten away with it.
Well, you raise an important distinction, and it is interesting. It's been 20 years since the Rodney King video, which was a searing image of what the LAPD looked like, and just, you know, it's interesting to just flashing back to what the LAPD looked like 20 years ago and what they are today. I mean, they are from an agency that had significant issues with the African-American community. That police department has really transcended those issues. But the Rodney King image it had a visceral impact. there was a part of that story that you wanted to know, well, what would lead up to that? But even having watched just the part that you watched, a lot of the takeaways from a policing standpoint was watching the supervisors stand there and not intervening. And that was one of the major takeaways from that, is, you know, responsibility to intervene in situations like that. The North Charleston situation is, I would say, significantly different. There's just no justification for what that police officer did, just absolutely none. And the Rodney King incident, there was no justification for that either. But there was a part you said, well, what would make these officers do that? Was there something that preceded this? But even whatever that was, what they did was absolutely wrong.
Do you think cameras in the hands of citizens help us to better understand what the circumstances are supposed to be when law enforcement encounters a citizen, that there's been a learning process here, not so much a confrontational kind of escalation going on?
When you think about cameras, you think about what is the narrative here? What is the perspective here? And I think one of the reasons that the police have embraced cameras is the recognition that citizens have cameras, and perhaps part of the story, their story, if you will, wasn't being told. So you have a citizen perhaps videotaping something that happened from their perspective at one point in time, but perhaps not seeing what preceded that action. So I think that's part of, you know, if you're trying to tell a story, how do you tell it from the beginning to the middle to the end? And I think the proliferation of cameras on the part of the police has been somewhat in reaction to the sense that citizens would sometimes film something, perhaps like an arrest situation, and hadn't seen what had led up to it. But still, there's a part of the story that we won't know. What is the background? What led up to this? What are some of the, you know, the other factors that might be important in telling the story?
Would you say that the takeaway ultimately here is that cops should behave as though they're being filmed all the time?
Here's the sad commentary. You should not need cameras to have police officers behave properly. I mean, that they shouldn't have to behave just because someone is looking at them. They should behave well because that's the right thing to do. And I would just add this too. Here's one of the cautionary things I would say about cameras. If we think that cameras are the panacea to these issues, I think we'll fall short, because what we really want to think about is, what are the policies? What are the training? What are the tactics? What are the ethics? What are all of these other issues that are involved in making these decisions? We can't simply say, give police cameras, and that will by itself change behavior. But if their policies are bad, if their training is bad, and if we're recruiting the wrong people, we're simply going to be recording bad activity.
Chuck Wexler is Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Thank you very much.
I have every right to record
actually,
you,
no,
sir.
You don't.
Yes, I do. The Constitution.
Actually, no, you do not.
It's not a police investigation.
First of all,
is that
in the Constitution? Know what you're talking about first.
I have every right to film.
Know what you're talking about first.
If you're not doing anything wrong, what's the wrong? You film us. Everybody films us.
What? Where's my camera?
This heated conversation is taking place right in that gray area of the legal domain outlined by Chuck Wexler a moment ago. In this case, a protester with a camera is confronting an officer of the NYPD. Does the Constitution protect your right to hit record on a camera in an encounter with the authorities? We put that question to Ellie Mistal, an editor at Above the Law, an editor-at-large of Breaking Media, and the managing editor of ATL Redline.
First and foremost, people have to understand that they do have a First Amendment right to videotape or photograph a police officer performing their duties in public. It's a constitutional right. Now, the way various states are going to implement that right is going to be different depending on the state. But as a general rule, you do have a right to pull out your cell phone camera, especially if you ask nicely, and videotape a cop. Number two, the officer does not have the right to take your cell phone and delete pictures or videos that you have recorded on that phone. That would be obstruction of justice and destroying of evidence. They might do it, but the few who have gotten in kind of significant legal trouble for doing that.
It's also important, Ellie says, to remember that you are suddenly in the middle of a crime scene, and that's not like filming a parade on the 4th of July.
Number three, you cannot trespass on private property while you're filming an officer. You can't break any other laws in the context of filming an officer. And you certainly can't obstruct police activity while you're filming an officer. Now, obviously, a lot of police officers are going to, when they try to make you stop, they're going to argue that you are obstructing their work and you are violating other laws. But that's where they're trying to get you. And you have to just understand what the trespass laws are and what, and make sure you're kind of out of their way as you're filming them. Number four, you got to remember what the federal statutes aren't as concerned about video as they are concerned about audio. It's the federal wiretapping statutes that get a lot of people in trouble. Now, the way that they're applied, again, varies greatly state to state. But let's take the Northeast. In general, in the Northeast, you're okay to record an officer as long as you do it open and notoriously, right? As long as the officer knows that you're recording him, they can't do anything to you. If you are secretly recording a police officer up here in the Northeast, things can get a little bit hairy. Other states, the laws will vary depending on the consent statutes they have for wiretapping and eavesdropping.
And finally, in a crime scene, the cop has a special authority to preserve evidence and order. So when a police officer decides it's time for you to stop doing something or to arrest you, you are obligated to submit. At that point, the court system, not your video camera, is your protection, something called due process.
Fifth, and I really think this is, in the world we live in, kind of the most important point. Look, the officer's word in an actual stop is the law, and I like my rights. I enjoy my First Amendment protections, but I also enjoy my carotid artery not being violated as well. So if the officer tells you to do something, orders you to do something, kind of, I would not put myself in danger. I would fight it out in court as opposed to trying to fight it out with the officer on the street. They are the law. In a very real and visceral way when you get into these issues.
Eli Mistal is an editor at Above the Law and editor-at-large of Breaking Media and the managing editor of ATL Redline. See Eli's list of five things to keep in mind when you are filming lights, camera, action. And to read about his concerns on the proliferation of body cameras, head to thetakeaway.org. John Hockenberry, zip code 11231. Steps from the water and harbor and tugs, a community of locals, first names, smiles, and hugs. It's a sliver of lowland that's sandy, soaked real good. You can forget the zip code. Everybody knows my neighborhood is called Red Hook. National Poetry Month is only part of my inspiration to scratch out rhymes about the place where I live. We got this idea from our good friends at WLRN in South Florida, who with the O Miami Poetry Festival are spreading poetry across the greater Miami area. Zip Odes, they're called. Five-line poems inspired and structured by your five-number zip code. Head over to our website, thetakeaway.org, for some more details about submitting your own zip ode. After you hear the ones we've been getting, you might have a few ideas of your own.
My name is Steve, and I live in Brooklyn, New York. My zip code is 11232, and this is my zip ode. It seems that many people have been buried here. This poem is about the beautiful and historic Greenwood Cemetery, home of Leonard Bernstein, Jean-Michel Basquiat, and other buried persons.
It's 478 acres, Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, with 560,000 buried persons. In Texas, zip codes begin with a 7.
My name is Lainey, and I live in Plano, Texas. My zip code is 75093, and this is my zip ode. Where there were once ranches and fields, now big box stores, subdivisions. Here, between the humming tollway and newly ringed roads, crepe myrtles bloom. My poem is about the beauty you can find in a landscape that at first glance seems scarred by suburban sprawl.
My name is Paul Westmoreland. I live in Van Alstine, Texas. My zip code is 75495, and this is my zip ode. I can see urban sprawl a-coming, up Highway 75 a-running. Where will I go? No escaping from these empty strip malls of woe. But a new Starbucks? Something. We live about 40 miles north of downtown Dallas, and our town of 3,000 is slowly starting to turn into something else. The cornfields are being turned into houses quickly.
Skip to the east and the numbers start with fives.
My name is Amanda and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. My zip code is 55108 and this is my zip ode. State Fair on Labor Day, best kind of summer heat, but the five-month winter frosts over the memory. The Minnesota State Fair is in my zip code, and it's one of my favorite things. I love the fair so much that I moved to this neighborhood just to make it easier to go several times every year. The fair ends on Labor Day and brings summer to a bittersweet close, but right now I'm anxious for summer to begin after yet another long Minnesota winter.
The seasons in the fives are not the same as the seasons of the eights.
My name is Joan, and I live in Cottonwood, Arizona. My zip code is 86326, and this is my zip ode. Oak Creek cuts through Red Rock Canyons, where a kestrel darts through azure skies, dropping straight down to catch a tiny motion in the air. My poem is about the beautiful Verde Valley where I live in central Arizona and about taking a spring hike and seeing one of my favorite birds, the American kestrel, catching something on the wing.
And number nine takes us to the other edge of the continent, the Pacific Northwest.
My name is Erin and I live in Seattle, Washington. My zip code is 98103. Soft mist drifts through forests, forming droplets upon whiskers. Once, an orca turned his eye toward mine. Once, there were starfish. My poem is about the natural environment and the sea here in Seattle, and also a commentary on some of our vanishing creatures.
Flowers bursting out of the ground in the twos down south.
My name is Stephanie, and I live in Charlottesville, Virginia. My zip code is 22903. Magnolias grow smaller on mountainsides, where wind whips red brick to red earth, vines reshape ruins. My poem is about the strange confluence of climate and history in Virginia. We are just barely warm enough to support southern plant life in our heavy clay soil, but the crumbling country architecture is definitely southern.
We want to hear your zip ode. Head over to our website at thetakeaway.org to submit a poem about the place where you live, or leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And Moo, working to help bring business stories and brands to life through a range of printed products like business cards, flyers, stickers, and postcards. Also offering design templates and the option to upload a personal design. Learn more at Moo.com.
In the spring of 1975, America had begun to move on from the experience of the Vietnam War. But the war was still going on between the South and the North.
The final battle of Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
Panic has swept from the coastal cities, crowded back streets and pagodas onto runways at the airport.
Our plane is surrounded here. I don't know how the hell we're going to get out. We're racing down the runway, leaving behind hundreds and thousands of people.
News footage from CBS News and the Rory Kennedy documentary Last Days in Vietnam, days when people went from being citizens to being prisoners to entering a life as refugees and immigrants. Andrew Lam grew up in Da Lat, the son of a South Vietnamese general, and at the age of 11, he was on one of those last helicopters to leave Vietnam in the spring of 1975, along with his mother, sisters, and grandmothers. Lam and his family landed in a strange place thousands of miles from home, one of the first refugee families to arrive in the United States after the war, and one of the very first to arrive in Daly City, just south of San Francisco, where he found a new life, eventually to become a celebrated writer of stories and commentary on the Vietnamese diaspora. With Takeaway producer Jillian Weinberger, Andrew Lam went back to the place where everything was once unfamiliar and brand new.
There's a lot of memory with this building because it used to be an ice cream store. And when I was young in Vietnam, the only impression I have of America is that it has 31 flavor ice cream. On my 12th birthday, I remember my cousin gave me a quarter because we were so poor when we just got here. So, and I went here and got a double scoop ice cream for my first time in America.
Today, we're in Daly City. The tech boom has sent real estate prices skyrocketing across the Bay Area. But Daly City hasn't strayed too far from its working-class immigrant roots, just as Lam remembers it.
When we got here, there were a mixed group of people, which is always the case of Daly City. Black, Filipinos, Samoans, Nicaraguans. And I experienced some racism, but in general, I would say that it was an extraordinary America that welcomed me.
How does it feel just to be back in the neighborhood?
You know, it actually brings back a sense of joy. I remember when we bought that house, we were so happy because we had become a middle-class American family within 3-4 years' time in America. Instead of refugees, we became immigrants. You know, we were not just a people fleeing anymore, but we were people who slowly have our roots embedded in America.
In a story called Show and Tell from Lam's recent collection, Birds of Paradise Lost, a young Vietnamese refugee arrives in a Daly City classroom in 1975, at the age of 11, just like Lam.
I was the first refugee kid to enter an America's classroom in 1975, right off the television, because it was the first television war in America. So the kids, even though they didn't know much about Vietnam, they saw images of it nightly with Walter Cronkite.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
And here I was, this kid that was at the other side of the TV set, emerged into their classroom, so they were really fascinated.
Our next stop in Daly City is the Vietnamese restaurant owned and operated by Andrew Lam's aunt and his first home in America, the two-bedroom apartment above that restaurant, which once housed 16 of his family members.
And so this is my first home in America, and it hasn't changed a whole lot 40 years later, which is really amazing. So we remember 6233 as the restaurant and 6231 as the apartment.
Lam's aunt eventually sold the restaurant to his mother, and his family spent the next 4 years there. Today it's called Manila Restaurant, and it's owned by a Filipino family.
I want to try something. My parents used to own this restaurant many years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
So, over two plates of Filipino barbecue and rice, I asked Lam about the beginning of his new life after he left Vietnam on April 28, 1975, and arrived in the Bay Area, then the epicenter of the anti-war movement.
There were a lot of anti-war people in this country, and back then I wouldn't want to talk with them because the American withdrawal from Vietnam basically caused South Vietnam to fall apart. And so it's fine to be anti-war, but what about the people that you encouraged to fight and abandon in the middle of war, you know, battlefield? I ran into the same kind of attitude when I was in Berkeley, for instance, where people romanticize Ho Chi Minh, whereas I regard him as the cause of my own sufferings.
For many refugees, that suffering made talking about life in Vietnam before or after the war difficult or impossible. But not in Lam's family, at least when it came to the war and its aftermath.
I'm really lucky because my parents have been in sort of a leadership position. They were public figures. So for them, articulating about history, about what happened, it's kind of normal. But I've run into kids when I gave my talks, Vietnamese kids who are born in this country, who read my book and came up and said, I really want to thank you for writing this book because now I know what it's like for my parents. They never talk about it.
And so many of these refugees, silent on their suffering and their personal lives, landed in the Bay Area in a time when the division between the private and the public was eroding, an era of frank talk and action on race, gender, and sexuality.
One of the most conservative people in the old world were picked up and then deposited in the land where you have love inns, drop out hippies, you know, summer of love, right? It's a cultural shock for sure. When I was a young teenager, I remember Harvey Milk being killed, and I didn't know what that was about. And my aunt would drive us afterwards down Castro, and she said, these are gay people. And I didn't know what that means, except for, of course, my eyes started to wander.
And it seems that while Lam's parents talk frankly and openly about their wartime experiences,
Their fully Americanized son still knows there are some topics he can't broach.
The story of my life, unfortunately, is on Wikipedia, but there is no such thing as coming out in my family because you don't talk about these things.
Andrew Lamb talking to The Takeaway's Jillian Weinberger in Daly City, California.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This podcast of The Takeaway is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. I'm John Hockenberry. Our partners include WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and The New York Times. If you'd like to know more about the program, you can find out more about me and the team at thetakeaway.org. We have brave, brave people here in the studio. Live, brave people here in the studio. In the kitchen, when you have before you the grave and hallowed responsibility to put together an important family meal, to cater an important dinner party, even an elaborate picnic, if that is the task before you, what do you want? Who do you want most there in the kitchen with you? The world's most complete database of exotic ingredients and practical recipes, or the world's most annoying digital busybody? Well, that's the question when you invite the world-famous supercomputer Watson from IBM into the kitchen. And I'm not up for this, but Dan Pashman and Manoush Zomorodi are brave enough to actually match their tastes against the winner of Kasparov and Jeopardy. Dan is host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast and Cooking Channel's web series, You're Eating It Wrong. Manoush is host of WNYC's podcast, New Tech City. What a great collaboration, you guys, and welcome.
Right? Thank you. Good to be here, John.
Yeah. Right. Now many the Watson people have been trying to get Watson to do more human subjective-y kinds of things with its software. So there have been chefs who've been working with Watson. And one of them is actually Bon Appetit's Dawn Perry, who's been testing a little bit Chef Watson's recipes. And she kind of gets sort of the limitations of Watson here.
There are definitely things that Watson can't experience. And for that reason, it's presented some challenges. Like Watson suggested pureeing an avocado into a gazpacho. Delicious. Not pretty at all. And because I think visually when I'm developing, I was like, Watson.
All right. So
what she's describing there, John, right, is this idea that what Watson does is you type in the ingredients like you would with any sort of, you know, cooking app. But what's different about Watson is that it analyzes the flavor compounds in the ingredients and finds ways of combining them that you may never have thought of, that a regular recipe database would never serve up. And so it's going to come up with things that are very different, as Dan and I found.
Yeah, I mean, it told us to cook our avocado, and we were neither Manoush nor I had ever done that, and neither of us are trained chefs. I'm a pretty good home cook, but we both thought that was going to be pretty gross. And so the idea is that Watson is learning in the process of doing what it does. It's not simply regurgitating what's been programmed into it.
So Watson didn't suggest take this out and bury it in the backyard for a week or something and then bring it back in. That would be a great idea. I mean, Watson isn't saying things like you need more neutrons here in this in this garnish.
No, what it did do, though, is what we did. We went through my kitchen. We found a few things. I hadn't gone to the grocery store that week. We put in that we had Brussels sprouts. We put in we had avocado. And I sort of thought, we'll see what it comes up with. But what it had us do was actually cook the avocado into the Brussels sprouts. So it became this delicious, what did you call it, vegan butter? It became like this delicious coating over it and gave this fatty, unctuous, I think, was the word that you used, Dan. Yeah,
that's my go-to food-describing word, unctuous, yes. But, it coated it in a kind of fattiness that made the Brussels sprouts feel really decadent, much more so than they would have just cooked in olive oil.
Now, in this particular case, unlike Bon Appetit, you guys are doing this sort of roll-up-your-sleeves, absolutely practical, right in your kitchen with
Excuse me, John. My sleeves were rolled up. Manoush was mostly drinking coffee and heckling me from her kitchen table, but yeah. Sure.
There's lies going on here already. I think this, yes, there was a, what we wanted was something delicious, which I think we got, but we also tested the limitations of IBM Watson, which was, we said we wanted to put bananas in. Watson forgot about the bananas. At some point, really? Dan looked at me, he's like, wait a minute, I got this garlic. Why haven't we put the garlic in yet? Watson also forgot about the garlic. So the human beings actually really proved their worth in the kitchen when this happens. And I think we should point out the reason why IBM is doing this is it's sort of a softer way of introducing this idea of cognitive computing into regular life, right? I mean, the friendliest place to use this is in the kitchen, hanging out with Dan, drinking coffee. Watson, you forgot about the garlic. But what we know is IBM just made a huge deal this week with Medtronic, with Apple, with Johnson & Johnson. They are getting into the health field. That's a little bit more scary that they're looking at our health data. So the kitchen is really the best place to introduce this.
All right, all right. Manoush, you make a good point.
Thank
tech,
you.
Tech, we want more tech. We tech. Did you really think at the end of the day that you needed a Watson app in your kitchen to make food for your family?
I don't think that we felt that we needed it, but okay. I do think that
I was asking Manoush.
Here's the thing.
Did you need it?
Do I need it? No, but like okay. I don't need a lot of things all in right. my life, right? But can all I just right. point out, I don't like to cook. I'm easily bored. I'm constantly looking for creativity.
So it might be a helper.
It could, yeah. I mean, I feel pretty proud of us. We made a big discovery. Mm. Like we made something really delicious pretty quickly. We needed a little bit of human input, but it came up with something that was so different that I felt there was a creative moment or spark that okay. happened in
and,
my kitchen.
And Tashman wasn't controlling everything.
He's a good chopper.
He's a good chopper. Nice.
Yeah.
Now, did you try to trick it? I mean, say things like, how much sriracha should you put in an infant's baby food? And it would have like gone, no, idiot, don't do that at all. What do you think?
I think Watson's not quite as dark as you, John. I think that Watson wants to come up with creative solutions and doesn't want to torture people.
Well, I just want to know if it figures out what humans don't want or what humans can
yes,
do.
Yes, and that I think humans. It's very – no, you're absolutely
not
right.
Dark, sick people like me, humans.
So what it's doing, though, is it's taking Bon Appetit's thousands of recipes. It's going to Wikipedia. It is going to the Department of Agriculture's database and coming up with these wild combinations that it knows could work.
The idea is that the more flavor compounds the ingredients share, the more likely they are to be used together in Western cuisine, and therefore we think the more likely they are to taste good together.
So that's a software engineer at IBM talking all about how they're trying to solve this problem.
Yeah.
And do this exactly right. Florian Pinnell.
Yep.
Smart guy.
That's right. But you know what's interesting is this idea of the finding common ground in these different flavor compounds. That's how Western cuisine works. But actually, in Eastern cuisine, it's built much more on contrast between flavor compounds and spices, especially in Indian and Chinese cuisine. And so if you want to use Watson to cook that kind of food, you actually need to ask it to come up with a recipe that has a very low synergy score, which means mm-hmm. contrast instead of synergy among flavor compounds.
Well, great work, guys, helping Watson to understand what that thing called food is that humans eat. Dan Pashman, host of WNYC's Sporkful Food podcast and cooking channel's web series, You're Eating It Wrong, and Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's podcast, New Tech City. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
And here's something for you to take with you today, some food combinations you can try at home from some of the folks who contacted us from Akron, Ohio. Horseradish and red raspberry jam on roast beef and melted Swiss. I'm not particularly fond of sandwiches, but this one is especially delectable.
This is Ian Smith of Salt Lake City, Utah, and I like to put sriracha hot sauce on glazed donuts.
Hi, this is Chelsea from Salt Lake City, Utah. I love eating Cool Ranch Doritos in cottage cheese. I eat it like a dip. It is yummy, even though it doesn't sound like it is. You gotta try it. Yum.
By the way, that Brussels sprouts Watson recipe is up at thetakeaway.org. You can listen back to anything on the show as well. Got a question for me? I'm at Jay Hockenberry on Twitter. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.